Welcome to the post-show chat from it's like chats from a prison cell. This part of the evening is being recorded for our for the project, for the research elements of it. But don't let that inhibit anything that you might want to say. My name's Peter Cann. I'm the director and writer of the project. Probably most people know Professor Hilary Marlin from the Centre for the History of Medicine in England, and you've already seen Jill Dowse, one of the performers. This is your opportunity to say anything you want about the show and to ask us any questions, either about the history of the research or the style of the production or the content of the production. It's as you, if you've had a chance to read your program, it says that this is the third in the Asylum Trilogy, what we call the Asylum Trilogy of plays about the history of madness. So my first question for Hilary is, why prisons? What made you light on this subject for the third part of the trilogy?
Yeah, I mean, our previous collaborations have been, as you say, they're very much about the history of mental illness, and particularly in institutional settings. So we did, the first piece was on the private asylum trade in the 18th century, and then we did a piece on migration and mental illness in 19th century asylums. So we had various ideas, and we'd even discussed things like neurasthenia, the movie, or something like that, or the musical. But I became increasingly fascinated by prisons and the question of the problems that prisons faced from the 18th century onwards, but particularly in the 19th century, with large numbers of prisoners either going into prison with mental health problems, or their mental health problems or mental health problems being caused by the discipline itself. And I think I also became fascinated with this story because of the resonances with current day issues in the criminal justice system, where we know that today that large numbers of prisoners suffer from mental health problems. So we were fascinated by that historical continuity. No one had looked at much historically at the question of prisons and the relationship with mental health. Yeah. So that was another reason for starting it. And the prompt was to visit to the Eastern State Penitentiary, where I went with a couple of colleagues when we were at a conference in Philadelphia. And it was just amazing to look into these separate cells. I mean, the reactions that caused, it was quite a visceral reaction, because it's really shocking to see these tiny white spaces where prisoners would be confined for 23 hours a day. So could I ask you, Peter, in turn, what it's been like working on these historical projects and working with historians?
Well, it's great. One of the best things about it is you do all the research. It's just there. Like sheaves and piles of books that I can sift through and find what's going to be what I consider to be important, and then pass that back to you and Catherine and say, well, is this what you want? So that's great, because you've got all the research there, and then there's anything I didn't know, I could just phone them up or say, tell us this, we want to do this, tell us this. So that part of it's great. It was challenging. This one was particularly challenging because of the particular material, and our job was to make to present a piece of engaging and accessible theatre which remained faithful to the serious research. So that's a great challenge. And the other is, how do you do a play about solitary confinement? Mm-hmm. So that presented interesting challenges. And then the process, it's always a two-way thing. It's a collaboration. And then the actors and everybody else comes on board. The first impulse for it was actually the set. It was a visual idea from Janet, the designer. Had the idea of doing it around a table, which could be a board table, a table where commissioners meet, and we could make it the cell, etc. So I'm going to bring Jill into the conversation now. She slipped away to join the audience thinking she could get away with it. She can't. So for you as a performer, working with this kind of material, what challenges did it present?
What challenges Challenges. It's a very hard question.
Well, one of them I know was getting your gob around all
those. Yeah, that's really, okay. That is a real challenge, is getting your mouth around the arcane, archaic language that that the reports express themselves in. And that, I think I would be right in saying, for the three of us, that has been the kind of, the thing that we worry about sometimes. So that is, that's a challenge. Apart from that, it's sort of, it's acting, isn't it? You know? you're always, as an actor, you're always kind of putting yourself in imaginary sort of situations. So in a way, it doesn't feel any particularly different. But I think what has been really interesting is having yourself in rehearsals every now and again, so that we can check that we've got the right power dynamics, for example, between the different the different people, like the doctor, the chaplain, and the schoolmaster, so that those scenes actually shifted quite a lot once Hilary had come in to tell us a bit more about how the hierarchies worked. So from that point of view, it's really fascinating, and it's I suppose just from a perform, I don't know, from my perspective, it's a privilege to be able to bring somebody else's research into a public domain in a different way, so that hopefully it reaches more people. Yeah.
So it's over to you now.
I've got a mic if anyone wants to ask a question. It won't amplify you, but it will record your answer.
Yes, we have a gentleman over here.
I don't feel like a dolly.
Thanks.
It won't amplify you, but it will record you.
I'm assuming that all three of those prisoners were A, real, and B, male. Was this system used for female prisoners in Victorian England as well? Solitary confinement.
It was, and usually it was adapted to a milder form. So women tended to be put in shorter periods in solitary confinement. So 4 months was a more typical period of confinement. But yes, they intended it to be applied to women as well. And you get these occasional comments that this was regarded as a particularly severe punishment for women who really like to gossip and chat to each other. So it's much worse for women than for men. But, partly because of ideas, I guess, about female nature and temperament, they were regarded as being completely unable to endure initially 18 months separate confinement that the male prisoners would go through.
Is there a clear moment when it turns from supposedly helping prisoners to punishment?
Well, there is.
It's
quite interesting because Pentonville in London is the first prison in England to introduce the system of separate confinement in 1842. And actually rather rapidly there is concern after a few years really about the high incidences of mental illness and mania and delusions amongst the prisoners. And it's actually the chaplain in Pentonville who starts to raise some alarms. The two commissioners that were mentioned in the play, Crawford and Whitworth Russell, die in 1847. And after that, the system is moderated. So the separate stalls in the chapel are dismantled. The period of separate confinement is reduced. But it stays in place right through the 19th century because there was such a faith in this idea of a uniform system of discipline. And actually in the 1870s, it gets even harsher. They bring in new legislation to centralize prisons in England and Wales. And the system actually at that point becomes more penal, and they start to mock even the early efforts of reformers. So the separate cell from the 1870s onwards is much more about punishment than reformation.
Was it considered a success?
Was it considered a success?
What
justifies it nowadays?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, yes, of course, there are many prisoners worldwide still in solitary confinement. I think, as the play indicates at the end, it wasn't considered a success, but they stuck with it because it seemed to have the potential initially to reform, but then to punish, but yet they still had these incredibly high rates of reoffending. So prisoners clearly weren't reformed by it. I mean, initially it was easier because after 18 months separate confinement, you sent the prisoners off to Australia as convicts. But by the 1850s, the convict system had broken down, so they would be sent to labour prisons after the period of separate confinement. So in a way, it didn't work, but for some reason they stuck to this system. And of course today, this is one of the horrifying things, that so many prisoners are put in solitary confinement either as punishment, or perhaps even more shocking in some ways, that in a prison system that's under such severe pressure that because of overcrowding and a lack of resources, that prisoners end up being in their cells today for 23 hours a day. At 40 minutes exercise, even less than they would in Pentonville in the 1840s.
And to put it into a bit of perspective, what it changed from was the just the overcrowded communal cells, which have been the system since the medieval times, which were disease-ridden, basically oubliettes. People were put in there and forgot about, with very little medical care, very little, there was no reformative element to those at all. It was thought of as a reform, as a more humane method of dealing with prisoners, and an experiment which, although there was evidence to say that it didn't work, it was stuck to. You had a question.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask if. Did they have any daylight in their rooms at all? I mean, were they just in a room without
anything? There were windows. In fact, in some situations, the prisoners complained, as they did in the play, of the brightness and the whiteness. And in one or two prisons, they had to kind of repaint the cells because the prisoners were literally dazzled in these white cells. If you broke the prison rules, for example, by communicating with each other or by feigning illness or insanity, you would then be removed to the dark cells, which tended to be underneath the prison, and they were dark, and you would be left in there for periods of several days at a time as punishment.
Yep.
Can you say a little bit more about how the collaboration works between the director and the actors and the researchers?
The initial research is obviously done by people who know what they're doing, and then it's passed on to the rogues and vagabonds. And the process was, there was initial meetings between Hillary and Talking Birds, which is where the idea for the table and doing it in the round, so you're looking at an examination, came. And then I was brought in, given all the material, and came up with a proposal for a way of doing it. Then I write the script, show it to Hillary and Catherine, and then when the actors come in, then we start playing with it, working on it. And more changes come with working with the actors, because the actors bring in their creativity. Once you start putting the characters onto stage and bringing what the actors bring in, something new comes to it as well. And then, as Jill said, with having Hillary in the rehearsal room looking at things, things then change again. We could ask Hillary questions and say, well, yeah, you can do like, as Jill mentioned, the hierarchy in the prisons. But then also the ideas come for development of characters. We have to confess that your question over there, or your was that the characters are based on real characters and real accounts and real sort of incidents, but they're fictional characters. And one of the reasons for this is, the other thing we had to bear in mind is that we didn't want to have a named prison, because the show is going to Dublin and going to Belfast as well, so that we wanted to something which was more general. So it's a very, and we've been making changes until yesterday in the script and how we do things, because the theatre's organic. And what's great is having researchers with you that helps that organic process as well. So it's collaborative all ways along. And the other big thing in the collaboration was the soundtrack. One of the challenges was representing solitary confinement in silence. And Des said, well, we have to have something which is theatrical silence. So there's the soundtrack that runs all the way through it was part, and that was organic as well, developed as we went along. So all stages of it were quite organic, as I believe the best forms of theatre making are.
And I think it's really exciting as a historian, and we should say Catherine Cox in University College Dublin she's a co-PI on the project, so she was very much involved in this collaboration between Warwick and UCD. It's sort of exciting as historians, really, because you have these wonderful records, but what Peter does, it sounds corny to say he brings them to life, but he fills the gaps, the places we can't go as historians, because we do not know really, although there are some good prison memoirs which prisoners wrote after leaving prison, but we only have a few impressions really of how prisoners experienced prison and the experience of solitary confinement. So I think this is what's so marvellous about this collaboration. And Janet, I don't think Janet's here tonight, wrote this wonderful blog which talked about Hilary Mantel's Reef Lectures and this idea of the difference between historical evidence and then going on with that process. But consider this is what it might have been like for these characters. And I think that's very exciting as historians to be involved in this kind of work, which builds on our evidence, but in this wonderful creative process really brings these stories to life.
It's really interesting. It's interesting that you mentioned Hilary Mantel, because I listened to her, because she's a great, I've always admired her work, and listened to her talk about how you deal with historical material was a vindication of how we do it. Mm-hmm. There is no truth. There's only points of view, but you're having to balance that with the marvelous in-depth research that we have, and then being able to be free enough to then theatricalize it, to make it engaging, to make it stories about people, as you say, is the reason for doing it in a theatrical way rather than just presenting the material in a written form. It's a different way of presenting the material.
Yay. So you're saying that you, you've collaborated, and it's to show the stories and the historical context in a different way and bringing it to life. But then moving forward, what is your aim with this piece? What do you want to do with it moving forward, or how do you want to present it?
Well, you're best to answer that, Hilary, because it's the other side of it is the non-theatrical side of it, which is equally important.
Yeah. Well, I think. And what we found with all these productions is that theatre gives you this space, this place to talk about mental illness in a much more frank and open form. It's a difficult subject to talk about. So I think that's important, actually, just part of this process is to open up conversations about mental illness and what it's like and how it affected different people in the historical past, but also to reflect on how it affects people now. But yeah, I mean, one of the things we aim to achieve in this project is really to try to use the historical process and our historical evidence to kind of think about current issues in terms of prisons, because there is this very long continuity of mental health problems in the prison system, and there's also a long continuity of that being associated with the particular forms of discipline. And I think by working with the theatre you can kind of amplify in a way the historical research to make it more accessible to reach different audiences, and perhaps, I mean, this is very ambitious, but it'd be really nice. We're also doing this event in London, and there we're really hoping to get some stakeholders, people in NGOs like the Howard League, Prison Reform Trust, perhaps policymakers along to sort of present our work there. So it would be brilliant if this had a wider impact as well.
But in practical terms as well, it will be filmed, filmed properly, not as the previous two were as well, which are put on the Centre for the History of Medicine website, Talking Birds website, and they do have a large number of hits. Yeah. And you use it to teach.
The filmed version
of it to teach. So it has a wider audience than the live performance does.
Question. Hi, I was just thinking that it seemed to me that the prisoners all became mentally ill. They weren't necessarily mentally ill when they went in there, but did you not want to do both sides of it, or was that your plan? They actually went mad because they were in solitary confinement.
I think both things were happening, and it's very hard to pull these apart in some ways, because I think it was even widely accepted at the time that it was testing, it was an experiment, and people involved in putting the system into place even talked about, you know, it's a very delicate experiment, and if you tighten the screws a little more, there will be mental and physical consequences. So there was this very strong sense, I think, that this was a very testing regime. I'm losing my thread here. Can you repeat your question? I've gone off on a tangent.
I mean, one embezzled, didn't they? And the other one did something else. So, you know, they weren't, was the idea that to even do those things you were, you know, mentally ill to start with? I don't think so. I suspect it was just that they went mad in there.
As today, many prisoners went into prison and they already had mental health problems. And it was kind of interesting as well, because one of the jobs of the chaplain and the other officers was to try to, I mean, they did this thing of damage limitation, really. So they were very keen to establish that prisoners might be mentally ill when they went into prison, or there might be some hereditary connection that an uncle or some relative had been mentally ill. So the chaplain would even write to local vicars to get information on, or is this sort of detective work, really? So the two things are going on at the same time, and I think that makes it quite tricky as a historical researcher as well, to really figure out, well, were there a lot of people who were mentally ill going into the prison system, or did the prison system make it worse? And probably it was both. And some people who observed the system talked about this. And prisoner memoirs are quite interesting as well, because they're written by the more educated prisoners, and they wrote for others in a way, like, as Oscar Wilde did, the observations of other prisoners. And they talk very clearly about both these things going on, that the prison contained many mentally ill people, but the system made it worse, and that many did get removed to asylums. And there was also quite interesting, Peter, the script mentioned feigning, because there was this constant anxiety about prisoners attempting to feign insanity. Yeah. So they would be moved to the asylum, which had a much milder regime. And, you know, they were where they had better food. Mm. They played cricket. So there was a lot of interest in detecting feigning as well.
Just to talk about the religious side, the curate, is how much has that changed over the periods that you've been looking at the 18th and 19th century? I mean, I don't know how important it is. I don't even know if it exists now to have someone like that always in prisons.
We still have prison chaplains. But the emphasis on the religious reformation is not as great. It's also not as monotheistic now, obviously, because our prison populations have a wider range of belief systems.
Yeah.
But I just know that they still have prison chaplains, and it sort of follows because of different social conditions. I think that the religious reformation isn't as much as it was. Mm-hmm. But what one of the things that Hillary pointed out to us was the huge amount of influence that the chaplain had.
Yeah.
The chaplain was the top of the pecking order.
Yeah. Yes.
So it was a very, very important element of it.
And I think, you know, many of them genuinely believe that this system would reform the prisoners. I mean, it's some of the aspects of it were really horrible and shocking to us. But there was, I think, for many of them, this genuine belief that they would reform. And they spent a lot of time in the cell. They really worked very hard with the prisoners to produce these kind of confessions and to converse with them. And there are a lot of accounts of some prisoners responding positively.
Doing confessions, you know, it's just people needing to let off steam in whatever way. But
well, some people have talked about it as being an early form of psychoanalysis even. In a very sort of skewed way.
Thank you.
What did they think was a level of success? So they kind of put somebody in a cell by themselves and they don't go insane. Was that like
that was
success for them? Or, I mean, what were they trying to do? And did they ever succeed with anybody?
Well, their ideal scenario was that the prisoner would sort of write this almost confessional statement. And Kingsmill, who was the Pentonville chaplain, published several books which contained these kind of statements, and other prison chaplains, or letters back from the colonies even, of, you know, prisoners, ex-prisoners writing back and saying, you changed my life, you know, you opened up the Bible to me, made me realise all my past errors, and so on and so forth. But the chaplains also, when they were writing about this kind of approach of the cell visitations, did talk about themselves almost putting the words in the mouths of the prisoners and talking about making the brawny navvy cry. Some of the language is very, very interesting. So, you know, but I think the confession and the idea that the prisoner was declared that he'd been redeemed was the ultimate goal. In terms of numbers, it's very hard to tell. I mean, there aren't even many good figures for showing rates of insanity in the prison. I mean, it's very hard to count cases. Also because they use such interesting language, and you probably saw that as well in the records, that it's not like asylum practice or other forms of psychiatry, because they use words like sullen or irritable. It's almost a different lexicon of talking about mental illness, which is used in the prison, which is also very interesting.
And in the reports, some of the measures of success were the, I suppose, the docility and the malleability of the prisoners. They accepted the system, and also they learned trades, or they practiced trades. Some of them did learn to read and write, and so there were some. Did show material development. So our brief was to look at the mental health, the effects on mental health. So we didn't concentrate on the more on the figures that gave us more positive sides of things. But there were some, or there were claims anyway. When you look into it, there's no real evidence that these are claims. These are just opinions, impressions, observations, rather than provable things that happened.
Hi, I just wondered, so we saw people then going off to Australia or coming to a tragic end and so on. Were some people released? Did some people achieve this, you know, confessional state of disciplinary release? And if so, what was the rate of recidivism? Because I think I mentioned to you before that, you know, going around Reading Jail and seeing all the photographs there of the people when they were released, these were photographs to go to police stations of people that the prison thought were likely to reoffend. So I just wondered if you could say something about that aspect of it.
The rate of reoffending was very high, and yeah, you're absolutely right. They keep close track on prisoners after they leave the prison system. I think it's very hard to actually, again, to get real figures during. I mean, there must be figures on the rate of reoffending, but that's something we haven't looked into in great detail. I'm losing my thread again. It's obviously I've got It's excitement.
I just wondered if you knew, because we were just, there's a lot of conversation about rates of success.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, obviously, that's one way of looking to see if it's successful. You do that to somebody for a year or 18 months, send them out, and then they're back in again. You know.
Yeah, they came back in again. And this is something that was commented on by people who said the system isn't working because they keep reoffending and they keep, or they're not being reformed. Many of them are not being reformed. And of course, after transportation ends, they will be sent for quite long sentences to labour prisons where they would work in associated labour. And the sentences were pretty long. I mean, people were sentenced for 15, 20 years for very minor crimes. But the rates of reform and the, were low overall, and the rates of reoffending still pretty high. And many moved off into the asylum. We finished because I keep forgetting. I keep forgetting the questions.
Last question, then, Jane.
So we saw a little bit in the play about how the prisoners got there, and I'm curious if you could say something about how the professionals got there. If you were a schoolmaster or a chaplain or a physician, was there a typical sort of trajectory for somebody in one of those trades to come to practice in the prison?
I think we probably know more about the. I mean, the doctor was always regarded, certainly amongst professional colleagues, as a lower status branch of practice to be the prison surgeon, although some of them were quite, you know, they were well educated. Some of them were also prison commissioners as well. Certainly in Pentonville, some of the physicians there are actually on the prison board, which is interesting. They were paid a lot less than the chaplain usually, which is also a way of marking status. But I think that, and my impression is for the prison chaplain, it was actually a role they, if you were had a, felt you had a vocation, that you would actually be quite interested in this work. And it was a very secure, pretty well paid, but extremely hard work. I mean, Kingsmill worked, in Pentonville worked 7 days a week. He had thousands and thousands of cell visitations. He preached on board convict ships before the prisoners were transported. There was a very tough job, I think, as well.
You did have you were pretty sure you'd have a full congregation.
You had a full congregation, a captive congregation. Yeah.
The story of the chaplain in the play was the chaplain before Kingsmill in Pentonville, based on him, who did offer his resignation in that resignation, but it was accepted.
Yeah. He was accused of causing an epidemic of religious mania because of his stringency and his over-enthusiastic preaching and the withdrawal of library books that prisoners were only given religious texts to read. So he did resign, as you say. Yeah. I don't know what happened to him after that.
Who knows? Great. Thank you all very much for your contributions.
Thank you.